On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
I can remember distinctly being a little boy in 1963 and watching on television from my home in Central Florida and seeing little black children, my age and younger, being attacked by police dogs, being attacked by firemen wielding fire hoses, and being attacked by policemen carrying billy clubs who were beating them and dragging them off. And I remember turning to my parents and asking, what is this all about? They didn't know exactly how to answer me at first. The camera has been an indispensable ally in the civil rights movement and to this day. And here to talk about that, Phil Allen Jr., artist, poet, storyteller, filmmaker, social justice and solidarity advocate, former NCAA Division I basketball player, full-time pastoral ministry for 13 years. He is a PhD candidate at Fuller Theological Seminary and is teaching and involved in diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting. He is the author of The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Black Moral Agency, from MLK to Darnella Frazier, and it's from Fortress Press. You can find out more about them at fortresspress.com. Should I call you Dr. Allen? I always feel funny when I know people are working on a PhD, and you might be ABD, or you might be almost finished with it. In any case, it's a great privilege to have you on the show with us. Maybe the safest thing to do would be to call you Reverend Allen, because that's a role that you have done well for the last 13 years.
Well, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me. I'm okay with Phil, I will totally receive that. That Dr. Phil, hopefully this time next year, it'll be true.
Awesome. I hope so, too. And I know it's a long and grueling process.
Yes.
What made you decide to write about the significance of the camera? And we're talking about video cameras as well as still cameras, and more and more so video cameras, even though there are some iconic images from the early days of the civil rights movement, including pictures and so forth, but it's really been the moving pictures that have made, I would guess, the most impact on people.
I think you're right. So what made me want to write this book, it comes in stages, what happened in stages. Initially, I was at Sundance Film Festival 2019, and I saw these films, and you know, I'd never been there. And when you go there at Sundance, you see films that you ordinarily are not going to see in the theaters.
Right.
They're not... Most of them are not entertaining. They're hard, emotionally draining, prophetic, if you will, messages, narratives. I was taking a class, and I wrote a paper called The Prophetic Lens. And that's where the idea started to percolate with my professor. I saw a film that really it was about lynching, and it was about a recent lynching. It was 2006 in North Carolina, but they used that to tell us the history of lynching. And it was so familiar to my grandfather's story that I was compelled to write about it and let that film kind of be very influential in my writing. And then fast forward to my own experience doing a documentary on my family's story, my grandfather's murder, and seeing the impact that the film had on people as I told the story. So that pushed me to think more about the camera, the impact of the camera. But then lastly, it was the Derek Chauvin trial. Seeing how the camera, the video image that Darnella Frazier captured was really the star witness. And then you listen to the jurors afterwards on CNN, an interview on CNN, they kept talking about the images. They kept talking about the video. And I was compelled to take that paper and expand it into a book and kind of unpack these ideas more.
I would also add at this point that Phil is the author of Open Wounds, the story of his grandfather's murder, his family's inherited trauma, and the possibility of reconciliation. Just hearing that description of this book makes me want to go out and get a copy of it and read for myself, too. One of the great privileges of getting to be around college students is getting to learn from them as well. I've been very privileged to have students who would talk very honestly with me when there were things in the news, because they're journalism students. We talk about what's in the news. I asked them when I've seen pieces on DWB and so forth. I said, okay, you guys grew up in the South. How prevalent is this still? Did you get the talk from your dad before you, when you became a teenage boy? And all of them kind of looked at each other and kind of grinned and said, well, yeah. And I said, so tell me what this has meant for you personally. And then they opened up. And some of them had been in situations where they just happened to be driving along and got pulled over and treated poorly because they were black and driving a car. And there'd been a report that a car like that had been seen at a party somewhere within several miles or so. And these were the first guys the police saw and pulled them over. And I said, did they apologize to you after they pulled you over for nothing? And he said, no, but we were glad they just let us go. I thought, this is really the core of the problem, isn't it? That it is bad enough that they're treated with disrespect, that they're automatically suspect, but even more so, it's like, oh, well, you know, and if not this time, it'll be the next time I pull you over. And these are smart guys. These are well-dressed guys. These are college students. They don't dress like hoods. They don't act like hoods. They surely would not have been. In fact, they left a party, which was not the one that was part of the story. They left a different party because when they got there, they realized that people were drinking and using substances they didn't think they needed to be around. And they were teenagers, so they just left. They never even went inside. And these are good guys. And it still manages to shock me that these things still go on. But I'm supposing for you it's not a shock at all.
Not at all. That's my story. What people don't realize, when we talk about what happened to George Floyd, what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, it's not just that they were killed, what happened to Trayvon Martin. It wasn't just that he was killed. It's the whole scenario, it's the whole event that begins with the profiling. It's one thing, you know, when you get a police officer gets a call and says a car fits this description, but what happens when it says the person fits this description? You know, that was one of my experiences. And multiple times I've been pulled over, twice in my own neighborhood, once while walking to the bus stop, the same bus stop I walk to every morning as a personal trainer, going to the bus to get to work. All it took was a black guy that I don't recognize in my neighborhood. And the way the police officer pulled up on me, I mean, my heart was racing because you would think that I had committed the crime.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, I didn't do it. I didn't know what was going on. I just kept saying, I didn't do it. And that marks you for the rest of your life. So when we talk about the issue of race and racism and white supremacy, I ask people to zoom out and consider the history, the lineage, the patterns. Every generation experiences this to some degree. And I try to get people to understand you are dehumanized when you're considered a suspect and you're just minding your own business.
Right.
And you know that it's because of the color of your skin. Those things don't surprise me.
It's a wrong place, wrong time. But if you hadn't been black, would they have stopped you? Would they have said, hey, buddy, do you know anything about this?
Yeah, and that's a good point. And even if I were white and they had pulled me over or stopped me, the likelihood, I'm sure there's some exceptions, but the likelihood of how you're treated. Let me give you an example. There's a young man I met with. He's in ministry. I met with him a few years ago, him and another guy. They wanted to have a conversation about race. And I was sharing my experience. I was sharing some of the things that we're talking about now. And he said, you know what? You're right. He said, I've been pulled over. I've been stopped for doing certain things in my neighborhood, in my community. And I've been caught with drugs on me. I was selling drugs. And both times, the police officers gave me a warning and said, he looked like a good kid. Hey, man, stop doing this stuff and let me go. Twice that happened. And he said, and I knew if I just dressed the part of a typical, not unassuming white guy, I can get away with it. And I did. He said, I knew if I were black, I would never have gotten away with it, at least not twice.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Phil Allen Jr., the author of The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Black Moral Agency from MLK to Darnella Frazier. It's from Fortress Press, and you can check them out at fortresspress.com. I've taught a class in propaganda, and one of the pieces that I show to them are excerpts from what I consider to be perhaps the most horrific film I've ever seen, and that is Birth of a Nation. Because of the fact that the man who created it invented a lot of stylings that are still used in movies, it's still taught in film schools, but with always the caveat, please don't look at the story of this. Just look at, hey, they zoom in or they fade to black or whatever. I had always heard of it. And then when I started teaching the class, I thought, well, I know this is a huge piece of propaganda. I remember reading that President Woodrow Wilson, one of the most racist presidents we ever had, watched it in the White House and encouraged everybody in the country to see this three-hour movie that was basically a recruiting movie for the Ku Klux Klan. And I watched it and I thought, this is horrible. This has every stupid cliche that you've ever heard or read about anywhere about whites and blacks, about the lost cause, blah, blah, blah. Do people still look at this movie and not see it for what it is?
You know, it's a great question. I don't know how many people actually watch the movie today. I think, especially young folks, I don't know how many are familiar with it.
Yeah.
But I think people watch movies like it, or they watch movies without reflecting on that lineage, like how influential, you know, the representation, the cliches. You know, I have friends, and I live just outside of Hollywood. I'm in Pasadena, and I have friends in the industry, writers, directors, producers, actors, and they tell me the story of how they have to fight behind the scenes to keep a lot of the cliches and stereotypes out of the script. In 2022, going into 2023, screenwriters, these are working screenwriters, and they're in the writing room. And when you have white screenwriters trying to write black stories, they usually build off of or play off of stereotypes, what they think this black person would say. And while some of it may be correct, there may be someone that would say this, but when it's filled with stereotypes and it doesn't capture the fullness of the black experience, then yes, they're drawing from not necessarily Birth of a Nation, but they're drawing from the lineage of Birth of a Nation.
Right. Gone with the Wind and so forth.
Gone.
Yeah.
Yes.
For a long time, Gone with the Wind was hailed as this great piece of history. The first time I ever saw it, I thought, wow, this is like a Technicolor version of, with better actors, of Birth of a Nation. This is not history at all. This is just a dumb thing. And I was flabbergasted that people were so agog over it. But of course, we have to remember the time in which it was released. I mean, it was only 20 years after Birth of a Nation, essentially. So things hadn't changed much in America in those 20-some-odd years. You also mentioned movies like The Green Mile and Avatar. Is that because in The Green Mile, there's an African-American man on death row, and he's not guilty? Is that part of what we're talking about there? And of course, to me, Avatar says that we shouldn't be looking at externals. But am I misreading that? Because in some of the notes that were sent to me by the publicist, that this is a line that stretches from Birth of a Nation to these newer films. And I thought, goodness, maybe I'm not being aware enough of what's going on here too.
Yeah, so when we think about something like The Green Mile, it's not just because he's a black man, he's in prison, but I think I talk about in the book, the analysis, not just mine, but also respected voices, and that's what I was trying to draw from. I was trying to use those examples beyond my own voice, of people who are looking at films critically in this way. But there was this idea of this black man at the end of the film, or as the film progressed, this pattern or this tendency to center whiteness, to bring it back to the place where this black man, his actions were to comfort or to care for or to make sure the white characters in the film were okay. As opposed to taking care of his own people, as opposed to the meaning and the value in his life, centering black life, black thought, black feelings, black concerns. Not so much the fact that he was in prison, but these films, what they do is they if you look at it critically and reflect on it, they're pulling out these indiscernible patterns of white supremacy, of racism, that we don't pay attention to, the centering of whiteness, the normalizing or what we call white normativity, the white messiahship, that there's been this salvific function attached to whiteness. These little subtle things are a part of what perpetuates racism, what, especially in film, these little messages, the messaging that's there. And so that's what I was trying to pull these analyses, these critics, their voices beyond my own, as I'm talking about Superman, as I'm talking about Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. I wanted to pull these other voices that have been critical of these other films as well.
I see it now.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, this is in the chapter Unfiltered Lies, White Framing of the Black Narrative, and this is where you talk about Avatar, and you quote the Ibram X. Kendi, who comments on the film, "In Avatar, the main white male character is portrayed as a complete failure, unable to walk literally and figuratively, and white society is sent to the hell of Pandora, where dark, enormous natives with braids and locks live, an undeniable symbol of a black society. Quickly masters the ways of the Na'vi, amazingly conquering Pandora's most unconquerable animal, amazingly out-excelling the Na'vi's best warrior, amazingly attracting the chief's desirable daughter, and most amazingly of all, compelling the Na'vi god to do something unprecedented, thereby saving them from annihilation. A projected failure in white society becomes almost godlike in the symbolic black society." Because often when people talked about Avatar when it first came out, we talked about, okay, is this like these are like the Native Americans. This is a symbolism of white people coming in and wiping out the Native Americans and treating them poorly, and this guy gets a taste of what it's like to be in this tribe and realizes that it's not what he's been told, that these people aren't the savages and all. So that was the way I sort of see it. But what you're saying is, no, this also reflects what it's like to be black in America, that this guy can kind of change his look and gets away with becoming a hero in this type of community, right?
Yeah, that's what you could totally walk away with that takeaway. But I think the biggest part of this is the symbolism that's couched in these narratives, in these beautiful story. And this is not to say that Avatar is not an amazing film. I love Superman, but I'm still critical of Superman in this book. But I still love Superman as a story, as a superhero. I still like Superman. But I also need to be critical of the messaging, the symbolism behind it. And these films do that. They continue the narrative in subtle ways. So what we don't realize is how far these narratives go back. They're ingrained in society. The symbols of black and white, black bodies and white bodies, and the meanings attached to them goes back to antiquity, to Greco-Roman interactions with Egyptians, and particularly with Cushites, with Ethiopians, Nubians. The darker the skin, the more dramatic the interaction and the meaning that were assigned to these bodies. They were radically different, white bodies and dark bodies. That messaging is still what we're fighting against today, thousands of years later. And it's ingrained in us. So when we see these films and the symbolism in who represents what, good or bad, stereotypes played out in these scenes, they continue those same narratives. And we embrace them uncritically.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Phil Allen Jr., the author of The Prophetic Lens, The Camera, and Black Moral Agency, from MLK to Darnella Frazier. It's from Fortress Press. How do we change the narrative? Is it by becoming more aware that there is a narrative? Because I'll be honest with you, the unusual thing in America about being white is you never think about it. But if you're not white, you always think about what color you are, because the narrative always involves your skin color or the shape of your face or your eyes or whatever. That becomes your identity. I don't really think about the fact that I have lots of mixed heritage, Scotland, Ireland, Norway, and places, all pretty pale people, which was not always an advantage when I lived in Florida or in South Alabama, where I would be delighted to have a little more melanin. But but what we're talking about here is, how do we get past the fact that so much is wrapped up in your appearance for your identity? How do we get past that?
Yeah, a great question. And I think you offered the answer. One, we have to actually acknowledge that there is a narrative around this.
Okay.
That it is a thing. We have to reflect on it. Like you said, most of my, I had a conversation once with a friend of mine. He's a white guy, a PhD candidate, soon to be doctor. And I did a lecture and I was talking about whiteness. And he said, well, if I'm not white, who am I? And I said, you have to go back to a time when you weren't white. That the term white has stripped white people, black people, Asian, it has stripped so much of our heritage, of who we are. I said, go back to a time when you weren't white, to the 17th century, when you would have been considered Scottish, British, Irish, what have you.
Right.
Right? But this term white came in, and then privilege was attached to it. And laws were built around protecting and preserving it and against those of dark skin, of African descent. So I think first we have to reflect on it and understand that it's a thing. Secondly, we have to take some time to actually learn the history of it. It's an ever-evolving narrative. I'm doing a study right now for a paper I'm writing for this class, this research, and it's an ever-evolving narrative. And most people cannot have a serious conversation about the ideology of whiteness without getting offended, by the way, because they can't separate the ideology from the identity. And I'm trying to get people to understand there's an ideology. There's a false consciousness that was created and that people live by, and people internalize it. White folks internalize it. Black folks have internalized the messaging that comes from it. Asians, Latinos, what have you. And we have to think about and reflect on what has it done to us? What are its effects on us? And then acknowledge that it's a real thing. And that's the starting point. And then I think we also have to grieve it. I think we have to be willing to lament, to grieve the reality, how we got here. We don't do that well in this country. Grieve.
Yeah. That's a theological thing that we can inject into this as well. That we don't lament, know, even though there have been churches that have apologized for their mistreatment of Native Americans, say, or of African Americans, or of other denominations, and so forth. That's a start. That's acknowledging that the wrong was done, and that there needs to be lament. We need to feel sorry for this. We need to do something about it, other than just say, "Well, I really feel bad about that." I feel like we could have a really nice long conversation, Phil. I'm sorry, it's only a 30-minute show.
It's all good.
But when I've seen pictures, for example, of Emmett Till, I'm just nauseated to think that people would do these kind of things, and yet I know what happened, and yet I know it in the minds of people it still happens, that there are still white people that don't like dark people, and I know it's not always easy for my friends who are black to be in a world that is primarily white, and I've seen them struggle with identity in lots of situations. And so I'm delighted that we opened this narrative. I hope that people will talk with other folks and say, what exactly are we doing here? And I bring up the theological aspect because I'm a retired Methodist minister, and I know that you have been a minister full-time for 13 years. So we can meet here as Christian brothers. And I think that's a powerful thing, that our image is not in our appearance, but our image is in our Savior. And yet we still have to be aware that the fact that there are people who are still being treated badly, who are being harassed, who are being killed, who are being disrespected, and all of that whole spectrum. We have to be aware of it and do what we can to start saying, let's quit doing that. If we're the majority for now, then we need to say, this is the end of this. We can't just check off the box. Oh, we had the civil rights movement. Okay, everything ought to be fine now. Let's move on to nuclear proliferation or whatever. you know, this is a lot harder problem to solve than nuclear proliferation, apparently.
Yeah. And so here's what I also hope that this book does, is that it yes, it uses the happening, the things that are happening, the killing, but I hope it gets people to start to think about the bigger, broader systemic issue that's built into laws and policies and hiring practices and how cities are arranged, organized, designed. Mm. It's built into the healthcare system. Like we need to start also looking at the pre-configured systems and institutions, structures that we navigate daily, that we feel, I as a Black person feel when I'm in and out of these spaces, and many people may not. I've even heard Black people say, well, you know, I've never really experienced racism. And I'll say to them, yes, you have. Look where you live. How many people live where you live that look like you? Well, not many. Exactly. That's a product of redlining. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And so, yes, the violence, yes, the happening, but the pre-configured institutions and structures and policies and laws that shape us in ways that we don't discern.
Yeah.
That's what we need to look at as well.
Absolutely. Phil, it's been a great pleasure to get to talk to you. Thank you. Is there a question that you'd hoped I'd ask that I didn't? Because there's plenty to talk about in your book.
No, I think I just love the conversation, man. I think you asked what was needed to be asked, and you shared what needed to be shared.
Well,
I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. And I know folks can find your book all the places people find books, bookstores, online, and everywhere, right?
Yes.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. We've been talking to Phil Allen Jr., soon to be Dr. Phil Allen Jr. His new book, The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Black Moral Agency, from MLK to Darnella Frazier. It's from Fortress Press. You can check the website, fortresspress.com. You can also Google Phil Allen Jr. To find out more about his work, his 13 years in ministry, and about his previous book, Open Wounds, the story of his grandfather's murder, his family's inherited trauma, and the possibility of reconciliation. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening. Get the dialogue started. God bless.